Good evening and welcome again to the Royal Institution. Life on other planets, whether humanoid or in other forms, is a favorite subject of science fiction. But tonight we're going to discuss its possibility in terms of fact. Our principal speaker, Professor Carl Sagan, is not a science fiction writer, but a distinguished astronomer and astrophysicist. He's been prominently associated with the American space program, including the search for life on Mars and elsewhere in the solar system. He's professor of astronomy and director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. Professor Sagan believes that the probability of intelligent life existing somewhere else in the universe is so great that we should now organize a sustained and long-range attempt to make contact with it. He believes that if we could establish communication with extraterrestrial civilization, great benefit would accrue, not just to scientific knowledge, but to the welfare of the human race. Three equally distinguished scientists are here to discuss with Professor Sagan the validity of his argument. J.Z. Young was until recently Professor of Anatomy at University College London. He enjoys a worldwide reputation for his studies of the brain, especially in the octopus. Christopher Longett Higgins is Royal Society Professor at Sussex University. He began his career as a chemist, but then turned to studies of artificial intelligence. And at present, he's concerned with problems of language. David Bates is Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen's University Belfast. He's the editor of Planetary and Space Science and has recently published a number of papers on the problems of extraterrestrial communication. And then our audience here tonight includes astronomers and physicists, as well as botanists and zoologists, anthropologists and historians, all disciplines which have something to contribute to the study of extraterrestrial life. And they will have a chance to contribute later. It's been suggested that if we're ever visited by beings from other worlds and they make the conventional request, take us to your leader, they will be taken to Professor Carl Sagan. And now here he is.
Thank you, Sir George. Are we alone in the cosmos? Is it possible by some poignant and fathomless joke that we are the only intelligent beings in a vast and awesome universe? Is it possible that of the 250 billion American billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, that of the possibly hundreds of billions of other galaxies, that we happen to be in the neighborhood of the only sun with an inhabited planet? Or is the opposite possible? Is it possible that on countless other worlds, there are beings who look up, perhaps with somewhat different sensory organs, and wonder as we wonder? Is it possible that there is a dazzling set of networks of intercommunicating advanced civilizations which fill the Milky Way galaxy? This issue can never be solved by scholastic disputation. What it requires is experiment. Only in the last decade have we gained the technological wherewithal to be able to send unmanned space vehicles to nearby planets to their search for life, if such there be. And only in the last decade or so have we achieved the capability to construct large radio telescopes which might conceivably collect radio signals being beamed our way by civilizations on planets of other stars. Now, with this radio capability, we come to an interesting point. Because only a few decades ago, we did not have the capability for interstellar discourse. And that must mean that if we were ever to succeed, we would be speaking not to a civilization at in some sense, our level of advance, but a civilization much more advanced than ours. There is no civilization in the Milky Way galaxy that can communicate at all that is as backwards as we. And that is a sobering point, but it is also a practical point in considering the question of interstellar discourse. The most modest assumption is that the transmitting and receiving civilizations have the same capability, namely our own. There is another consequence, and that has to do with the content of messages, if we are ever successful in such a search. It means that in terms of science and technology, if we are able to decode the messages, that there is an enormous quantum jump in learning which it is possible to garner from such discourse. It also has a variety of other non-scientific, more human consequences, the chief one of which is that it will deprovincialize the planet Earth at a time when it is becoming homogeneous, when cultural diversity is varying, is disappearing. At just that moment, if we succeed, we will have the opportunity of plugging into a great set of alternative and surely diverse civilizations. Now, to discuss this question, I would like to show one equation for capital N, the number of advanced technical civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. I will merely state, but not justify, the arguments, which are in any case weak for the numerical values for these factors. They are the rate of star formation, number of stars formed per year, times F sub P, the fraction of stars which have planetary systems, times N sub E, the number of planets per system which are ecologically suitable for the origin of life, times F sub L, the fraction of such planets in which the origin of life actually occurs, times F sub I, the fraction of such planets that are inhabited in which intelligent life evolves after some billions of years of evolution, times F sub C, the fraction of such planets inhabited by intelligent beings on which the intelligent beings develop a technological civilization. I am happy to define an advanced civilization as one that has radio astronomy. That's a practical definition. Times capital L, the lifetime of the technical civilization. Now, you will note that we run from astrophysics to planetary science to organic and biochemistry to evolutionary biology, anthropology, archaeology, history, and politics. There is surely no equation more ecumenical than this. And from the latter few sciences necessary to make an accurate assessment of Big N, it is clear that we are on very uncertain terms. We are not sure of these last few factors, least of all Big L, the lifetime of a technical civilization. Fortunately for us, but unfortunately for the discussion, we don't have a single example of the lifetime of a technical civilization, how long before they destroy themselves. Now, in some sets of numbers, which have become canonical but should be treated very cautiously, Big N turns out to be large, something like a million. If there are a million technical civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy, then it is easy to calculate that the mean separation between any two is a few hundred light years. That means that a single message and response takes 600 years, and it's not what you might call a snappy conversation. It means that there will be monologue and not dialogue. If there are a million civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy, then only one out of every several hundred thousand stars have such civilizations. That means that we have to examine, in some sense, several hundred thousand stars in order to have a fair chance of success. We have examined only several hundred stars in this way, and therefore have only done about 0.1% of the required effort. At the same time, the technological capability that we have at our command today without building any new instruments is far in excess of what is required to perform such a search. The largest radio radar telescope on the planet Earth, the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico, is capable of communicating with an identical radio telescope anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy with a bandpass of 1 hertz and a bit rate of 1 bit per second. Well, that's a lot more than 300 light years away. The trouble is a kind of lack of nerve rather than a lack of technological expertise. What is required is a few radio telescopes which carve up the sky between them. It's an excellent forum for international cooperation, and which devote a few decades for such a search. The cost is something like 10% of a single B-1 bomber that the United States is engaged in building. Well, if we succeed in such a search, we may plug into a new era in the history of our species. If we fail in such a search, we will have performed an almost as significant service. We will have discovered the uniqueness and rarity of this planet and its inhabitants. Either way, it cannot help but have a profound influence on how we view the universe and ourselves.
Thank you very much, Professor Sagan. I think we should start with the biologist's view of the probability of life itself, Professor J.Z. Young.
Well, Professor Sagan has given us really very little option because he says that his experiments are going to be successful anyway. I won't dispute that if we did find that we were unique in the universe, this would be a very strong confirmation of what I feel is the most likely interpretation of the data that we have, frankly. There are so many mays in what you say, Professor Sagan, so many perhapses, that are obscured to some extent, in my opinion, by this row of letters with their stars and P's and E's and L's and I's and C's. I'm not impressed by all this, frankly. Let's look at some knowledge that we do have, as you say, and you have yourself contributed to it, about how life may have originated, and therefore what the probability is that it has originated, even if the stars, the planets, are able to, were able from their composition to produce it. I think it's quite likely that organic molecules would be formed in many such planets. I think you won't take that to be controversial, really. Experiments have shown that organic molecules can be produced under suitable conditions in the sort of reducing atmosphere which was present at the beginning of the Earth's history and is likely to occur on other planets. But having got those molecules, how are we to suppose that they came together to produce a self-maintaining living system? Now, I'm a simple biologist, and I would like to concentrate a little on what is involved in being a living thing. It seems to me people talk far too abstractly about this. Living things do improbable actions, whereas a piece of hot lava coming out of a volcano will cool. A man will be able to keep himself warm even if he's in an ice-cold environment. Living organisms do improbable things to keep themselves alive. They can only do this because they've got information. From the past, they have learned, if you like to use that word, from their heredity, to perform these actions by the means of enzymes, complicated molecules, ordered, highly instructed by the heredity which has come to them from the past. Now, I would like you very much to tell us how you suppose that from this probiotic soup, it's called, isn't it, of organic molecules, quite complex, polypeptides maybe, specific enzymatic molecules can be produced. And not just one, but enough to make a self-maintaining system. A system that keeps itself intact, or has done on this Earth, for, what, 3,000 million years? Not only has it not run down, as all other systems do, but life has increased its negentropy during this time. Can you really suppose that this is a probable event? Now, I think most of those who've discussed this question have come to the conclusion that the probability is very, very, very low. Now, how low, we don't know, because we only have one example of when it occurred, ourselves, our own life. Therefore, we are not justified in saying that it's probable that it happened, even if there are 100 million planets where it might have happened. We just do not know.
Well, first, I must say I'm a little leery about deducing that the origin of life is unlikely, because in the one case where we happen to have any knowledge, we know it occurred. On the other hand, I'm fully aware that one is on very dangerous grounds in extrapolating from a single example. What I'm impressed by is that, let me give a three-pronged answer. First off, we have been experimenting on the question of the origin of life for a little over 20 years. In that period of time, starting from the most common atoms in their most common molecular configurations, we have succeeded in producing every one of the elementary building blocks of life. All 20 amino acids, all 5 nucleotide bases, ribose and deoxyribose sugars, and the polymers of these simple building blocks. So,
specific ones?
Well, permit me to come to that. Certainly specific ones, but not the ones that you happen to be fond of. Now, the difference between the ones that have been produced and the ones that you have an understandable predilection for is the fact that some work and some don't. And therefore, we must permit natural selection some time to select out in this molecular sieving the ones which work from the ones which don't. Since the laboratory experiments have only been going on for 20 years, we must not be too impatient, considering that the Earth has had many thousands of millions of years to do it. If at the end of 1,000,000,000 years, Professor Young, we fail, then I will be delighted to grant that you have a point. The second argument that I would make has to do with the paleontological timescales. The Earth is about 4.6 billion years old. The evidence from returned lunar samples is that the moon was in a stage of extensive melting as long ago as 4 billion years ago. There are no rocks on the Earth as old as 4 billion years ago. It seems quite likely that the Earth was not suitable for the origin of life until about 4 billion years ago. There are certainly fossils 2.7 billion years ago, the Bulawayan stromatolites. There's probably fossils, although there's some dispute on this, as old as 3.1 to 3.4 billion years. That leaves only a few hundred million years for the origin of life on the planet Earth. That is a time scale much less than the age of the planet. And if, in the only natural experiment we know, the process occurs faster than the time scale available, then that suggests, but does not prove, that it is a likely process. And the final point I would make on the origin of specific molecules, point out that you asked about enzymes. Enzymes, of course, many hundreds of peptides or more long, but the active sites of enzymes are only a few peptides long, maybe 5. And so if you take 20 amino acids and you ask, how many ways are there of assembling them, 5 at a time? The answer is 20 to the fifth power, which is about 30 million. You don't have to perform an astronomical number of experiments to get any active site you'd like.
You are, of course, taking the position that a natural origin, if that's the right word, is certain for life. Now, I am also a humanist, as I expect you are, and I don't suppose that life was suddenly produced by the outside intervention of some other agency. But we don't know how the universe began. We don't know how life began. And we're not entirely justified, until we have made it, in assuming that it didn't happen in some other way.
I agree. Since we are ignorant, how can we remove this ignorance? We cannot do it by performing laboratory experiments, because we are not patient enough to wait billions of years. The only way we can find out is by going elsewhere to see if there are other natural experiments. And in the case that life on Earth was made by a supernatural being, which of course cannot be excluded, although I know of no evidence for it. What a small vision of such a supernatural being to imagine that in this immense and awesome universe, this one tiny planet is the only one which he chose to make inhabited.
Why not? That's up to him.
Yes, I just say it's a rather paltry vision, but I agree. He may be that way.
Well, let's move on to another difficulty, a possible difficulty. I think Christopher Longett Higgins has some reservations about the possibility of communication with them, even if they're there.
Yes, I'd like to take up, Carl, one or two remarks you made in your opening. You said that if there are any technological civilizations which are capable of doing radio astronomy, then none can be as backward as we. It's quite possible, isn't it, that the people who would be sending messages to us would be frightfully good with their hands, in some sort of sense that, you know, people who are frightfully good at making wireless sets, although they can't tell you how they work. They needn't have a science to go along with their technology. But they might, on the other hand, also be frightfully interested in music, for example. Imagine a civilization of beings very different from us, who had enormous technological skills, but all they were really interested in communicating to one another or to anybody else was certain beautiful patterns. Now, we receive a message. Isn't it at least as likely, in fact, considerably more likely, that it's a message of that kind, rather than an attempt to spell out to us in the sort of languages which are discussed in some of the papers on the subject, you know, elementary facts about arithmetic or physics?
I love the idea of them sending music to us. In fact, Lewis Thomas, an American biologist, said that he thought that we should send in our first interstellar message Bach. And then he paused and said, but that would be boasting. I think it's clear that were we to send out a message in Bach, that we would not be attempting to communicate what I would call hard facts. We would not be attempting to communicate in terms of the commonalities between us and some distant and separately evolved civilization. It would be very idiosyncratic to send out Bach, although perhaps it would be appreciated at the other end. In a first message, we should attempt, I would think, if our idea is to be understood, to communicate in terms of what is held in common by transmitting and receiving civilizations. And the first thing that is held in common is surely the radio channel itself. And other things which are held in common are the astronomy and physics and chemistry of the universe, which we know from observation are the same.
But that is what I'm questioning. Does one have to have a science if one has a technology? I mean, there are many animals which do extremely clever things, you know, by ingenious technological devices, which doubtless they would be quite unable to describe in terms which we would be able to understand. It is much more difficult, I think, to decipher a message coming to us from somebody else than is commonly supposed. Because the matters of interest in the message might be matters which were simply of no interest to us at all.
My personal suspicion is the opposite, that it will be far easier to understand such a message than it is to understand, for example, the writings of the Mayans or the Cretans or the inhabitants, C-R-E-T-A-N-S, or the inhabitants of Easter Island, because those people, while close to us in time and identical to us in biology, did not share our technical civilization, and they were not attempting to communicate with us. The problem is one which is called anti-cryptography, the construction of a message so simple-minded that the most backward imaginable technical civilization would be able to understand it. By the way, on just one other remark, Faraday had to first do the displacement current before practical radio was developed and before the experiments of Heinrich Hertz. So I wonder if it is possible to accidentally stumble on radio telescopes.
Well, it's just that we can't get out of our own ways of thinking about what sort of a thing a communication is. It's very difficult to escape from our preconceptions. Mm-hmm. And one knows from studies of language how exceedingly difficult, in fact, it is to construct convincing models of how even our own children learn the languages taught them by their parents. It's a very remarkable performance at the best, you know, at the very least. It's something which obviously calls for a certain cast of mind in the child, which indeed has been assumed to be built in. It's such a wonder that our own children can understand our attempts to teach them our language, surely it would be even more of a wonder if we, the children, were able to decipher the messages of not our parents, but of creatures so different as these are likely to be, considering the possible range of variation that you might expect to find in technologically advanced communities.
I imagine that there is a kind of quasi-ergodic theorem in biology, such that the technological phase space is eventually entered. And once entered, it is occupied because those civilizations which have technology preferentially survive, except for those that destroy themselves. Up to a certain point, it is an advantage. That point may, if we are unlucky, be where we are right now. But surely the selective advantage of technology, as is clearly demonstrated by the demise of every non-technological civilization on this planet, means that no matter how improbable, once technology is developed, it wins.
But must it have a mathematics and a physics, anything like ours? I've wondered, supposing these beings were plasma-like, would they have set theory and mathematics?
Professor Young, I wish I could answer that question. I would be happy to simply be convinced of the premise, much less the conclusion, namely that there could be plasma sorts of organisms. But again, I would say that any successful technological organism has to come to grips with precisely the same universe that we have to come to grips with.
And that's the same manner.
Well, but that forces some convergence.
Each self-maintaining organism has its own system of information, its own system of transmitting it, its own system of communication. Well, and unless you understand that system, we don't understand the whales, after all, who are on this planet. And they've got a very fine information transfer system.
Let me be so bold as to give an example from sensory physiology. There is a vast electromagnetic spectrum, ranging from gamma and X-rays at one end to very long radio waves at the other. How is it that such a tiny fraction of that electromagnetic spectrum is used for the senses of all the organisms on the Earth? Just the visible, with a little bit into the ultraviolet that insects use and a little bit into the infrared that pit vipers use. Why are there no X-ray eyes? Why no large radio eyes? Well, the answer is clear. The physics forces it. The atmosphere is opaque. If my eyes were good at 10 microns, I could not see the finger in front of my nose. If I wanted to have a radio eye and have some resolution, I would have to carry on this immense thing with me, and it would be awkward. So the physics forces me into optical frequency radiation sensors. And that kind of forcing by the common physics, that's an allegory, not an example, yeah. Is what I imagine is happening. But I of course cannot be sure until we meet someone else.
Perhaps whether it's going to be Bach or mathematics, we ought to look at the the possibility of the technological possibility of this communication. And I know David Bates has given a lot of thought to this.
Well, perhaps I could commence with a question. You are, I have the impression, a committed man. About a year ago, you wrote with Frank Drake a letter in Nature, which you put forward a very ingenious idea to solve this very difficult problem, which you haven't mentioned, the problem that if we have a channel, let us say, 10 hertz wide, there are 1,000 million channels to choose from, and both have to be ringing on the same telephone. This is a formidable task, but we needn't go into it in detail, but you and Frank Drake, with others before them, have added to the list of the most logical possible channel. But writing in that letter, you said, you, a believer, if I might so call you, even under rather optimistic assumptions, the number of stars which must be searched must be about 1 million. You're now proposing a search of a few hundred thousand. Does this mean that you're making assumptions more favorable to success than those you so recently called rather optimistic?
No. A factor of 3 is as nothing in this business.
Yes. You speak of a few radio telescopes here on Earth. I'm not too clear how you'll overcome the problem of choosing which channel is going to be used. That is, we have these 1,000 million channels, and you've selected the one that, let us call them the Daleks, are using. And you tune your radio telescope onto that. There's still the problem, which of course you're familiar, that we have to be pointing towards them at the corresponding time that they are directing their radio telescope, if they're using a radio telescope, towards us. And the calculations show that the chance of that, if one was using a radio telescope, say a 300-meter radio telescope, as the Arecibo one, the chances of that occurring for a pair of dedicated radio telescopes, one on each planet, is remote. It's not a matter of, you mentioned, a few decades. It's a matter of a few million years before the two, by chance, would be pointing towards one another at corresponding times.
That seems to be rather a severe criticism.
Yes, it is. Only if we assume that we know which star it is that we're interested in hearing from at any given time. But if we make no prior assumptions as to which star we want to hear from and are open to all conceivable messages, then the calculation works out, well, in fact, Professor Bates and I have had an exchange of letters on this, that an effort by civilizations only slightly more advanced than we implies that when we run through the several hundred thousand or million other stars, then we have an excellent chance that one of them is pointing towards us. The key point has to do with the assumption of terrestrial levels of technology in the transmitting civilization. If we assume that, then we get to very infrequent successes. But as I tried to stress in my introductory remarks, no one who is communicating will be as backward as we. And the amount of effort necessary to make large numbers of transmitters is even for us today not comparable to anything like military expenditures, for example. As societies become more advanced, the technology becomes easier, the transmitters become more powerful, the effort involved in spending a great deal of time in transmitting becomes smaller. And I can very well imagine that it does not require the full efforts of a civilization, that it could be the efforts of some very small subset of a civilization. Boy Scouts, ladies' garden clubs, ham operators.
What's the power involved?
Well, for example, the Arecibo telescope, in its present configuration, is between, at certain bandpasses, is between 1 million and 1 billion times brighter than the sun at the same frequency. So were you to, I should come to the frequency problem, I haven't answered it yet. Were you to be lucky enough to tune into that bandpass, you would see something 1 billion times brighter than what ought to be there. You'd say, my goodness, isn't that interesting? Now let's see if it's changing with time. And if, for example, you were to get, as you would, a sequence of of numbers, which would be the pulse coding of the Arecibo radar, you would say, well, that must be artificial, although, Professor Mongewood Higgins, it would not be decodable, because it's a purely arbitrary set of numbers. Maybe I can say a word about the frequency. This is a diagram of the background noise temperature of the Milky Way galaxy as a function of the frequency, and this is the immense radio spectrum that Professor Bates was alluding to. Now, there are a number of sources of noise, some having to do with the emission from the galaxy, the natural sources of radio emission within the galaxy, some having to do with the quantum noise inherent in any radio receiver, some having to do with the 3-degree blackbody background radiation, which is a cosmological inevitability, and some having to do with the absorption by the Earth's atmosphere. You can avoid only the last by getting above the atmosphere. The others you have to live with, and so does everybody else. The resulting curve shows a minimum noise at a certain fairly narrow range in frequency. So if the idea is to communicate, especially over large distances, you pick the place where the noise is least. Now, within this frequency range, there are a few natural frequencies. For example, the 1420 megahertz hyperfine transition of neutral atomic hydrogen. The most abundant atom in the universe happens to give its strongest line right in this window. And there are some other, but not an immense number, of such lines. The OH radical does it. There are some others which Professor Bates alluded to that we've been looking at, but there's not an immense number. The total number that's been proposed by everybody in the last 20 years of worrying about this is maybe a dozen. Now, there exist 1,000-channel radio receivers at the present time. So you could, for example, which are in routine use, for example, in looking at pulsars, not invented for this problem at all. And so you could place 1,000 channels across here and look at 1,000 different stations at once and see if anybody's broadcasting on any of them. You needn't do the whole thing 1,000 times. You can do it simultaneously. And this multiplexing capability, I think, removes the at least a major part of the frequency selection problem, unless a channel is chosen for obscurity rather than clarity, and then you may never get it.
David Bates.
You spoke of the effort that the other civilization might make. A large number of radio telescopes, this is partially reverting back, I think, to something that happened a long time ago, but I think we should try and get into some perspective the effort that they would need if they were using radio telescopes. A number that was mentioned was 100,000 for the other civilization. You still stand by that? They would, if they choose to use radio telescopes rather than an omnidirectional beacon, dedicate 100,000 or thereabouts radio telescopes towards this communication problem?
Well, I point out that that's the number necessary to solve the problem in terms of omnidirectionality. And I mean, in terms of directed.
I mean, that's what they would use.
That's what they would have. That is the level of effort required, and they can do the calculation as well as we can.
Yes.
In order for us to succeed in
hearing
this.
Yes. Yes, we're in agreement.
Provided, yeah. If I may make just one proviso, that they have no idea which civilizations to send signals to. That is, we assume that they are absolutely ignorant about target stars. Now, I think that that is probably a very pessimistic assumption. I would imagine that a civilization thousands or millions of years beyond us would have a pretty good idea about which places are likely to have emerging civilizations,
yes,
and which aren't. But in any case, if they have no idea, then some number like the one I mentioned.
It's a very considerable effort for them to make, isn't it, if they are not going to get a reply back for 1,000 years.
Yes.
In their own lifetime. I mean, can you visualize ourselves doing it without the hope of ever knowing the result of our experiment?
It's a very interesting question, Sir George. I think one immediately has the sense that it would have to be a very mature civilization to do it without the hope of something in return. And perhaps the reason that that our minds often boggle at this prospect is because we are not used to doing such things without an immediate return. But also, as I mentioned, it doesn't require the Department of State of that other civilization to be committed to this. It only requires a small organization of interested people. See, the
with 100,000
telescopes. Yes, with 100,000 telescopes.
David Bates, I don't know whether you'd finished.
I hadn't really let go of these 100,000 radio telescopes, because you dismissed JZ rather lightly, I thought, when you spoke of the power required. But if we consider the power in terms of what we would say conventional nuclear power stations, then if the civilizations were transmitting 100 light years and they were of round about the same size as Arecibo, the power involved would be that corresponding to some hundreds of these nuclear power stations. And it seems to me that inherent in all your thoughts is something rather Victorian, that as technology advances, we'll become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And I think this is something that is perhaps not going to happen after all.
I think it is clear that for those societies for whom 100 nuclear power stations will beggar the society, we will not hear from those fellows.
Christopher, you wanted to...
Yes, I feel that we should really raise a rather tricky question, which nobody's mentioned so far, and that is the question of the possible degree of benevolence or malevolence in the people that might be communicating with us or with whom we might be communicating. I mean, when one thinks about communication between species on this Earth, or even between different, people on the surface of the Earth, one is not struck, on the whole, by the extreme benevolence of their intentions. If one thinks about our relationships with animals, for example, we may, find them delightful pets or interesting, useful for doing experiments on, or perhaps, delicacies for the table. Is it not possible that we might be so regarded ourselves? Then, would we be at all well advised to pay any attention to messages coming in from outside, even if, as I might allow you, we were able to decode them? And certainly we might be extraordinarily ill advised to let our presence be known.
The great advantage of the radio telescope also is that those fellows are some hundreds of light years away and we're here. So they're not here telling us or requiring us to do something, they're merely giving us their advice and we can ignore it. The other side of the coin, it's okay to listen, but for heaven's sake, don't tell them where we are. It's too late. I personally have the idea that any civilization which has made it through the epoch of technological adolescence would not be a danger to us. But in any case, it is too late, because we have certainly by radar, as I was mentioning before, a billion times brighter than the sun, we have announced our presence. And military radar for much longer than radio astronomical radar. Likewise, television. Television gets out through the ionosphere.
And so, listening in now.
In a few weeks, when this program is broadcast, it will escape through the ionosphere and spread out in a spherical wave front traveling at the velocity of light. And further away, there'll be some other wave front that the BBC broadcast the previous week, and so on, out some 20 or 30 light years into space.
Well, that seems to be a very good point to bring in the rest of the people here who would like actually to communicate to these people directly now. Yes.
Ian Roxburgh, I'm a theoretical astronomer at the University of London. I understand that we are not in a position to decide on biological grounds whether the evolution of life is probable or highly improbable. But let's say that it is highly probable. Why then do we not know about it? It's an old question, but it's one that has so far been avoided. If life is very probable, it happens within on one or around, say, one in every million stars, and there have been many, many millions of years, thousands of million years, in which those life forms could have evolved, surely they could communicate with us by physically coming here.
A famous question, as far as I know, first raised by Enrico Fermi with the statement, where are they? The range of possibilities is very large. Let me just tick off a few. One, we're the first. By some strange accident, no one has gotten to this stage before us. Number two, all civilizations rapidly get to this level and equally rapidly destroy themselves, so the steady state population at any moment is very small and there's no one around now. Possibility three, the galaxy is full of advanced civilizations, but there are technological difficulties with interstellar spaceflight that we do not now understand. If you were restricted to a tenth the velocity of light, for example, you could have many locales in the galaxy of advanced civilization and still many places that had never been visited. Possibility four, they are in fact traveling between the stars and have come to the Earth, but because of some reason that is difficult to imagine, or maybe not so difficult, a galactic ethic against meddling in primitive societies, they hide. Possibility five, they've come here, they're not hiding, but we're too dumb to recognize them. In the same sense that that an ant doing his anti labors by a suburban swimming pool is unaware of the function of this edifice around him. I don't know which of those is possible. I'm a little skeptical about number one, and past that I have no preference.
Will you accept one or other of those as a possibility?
I wouldn't like to go back through each of the list, but of course, from the first few, if we're number one, then there's, of course, no point in communicating.
Quite.
About the nature of the message to be sent out, and I just can't imagine how we can avoid making it too anthropomorphic to be likely to be understood.
A great deal has been written on this.
Well, for example, let me start with the simplest possible message. 1, 2, 3, 5. Suppose I run through the first 30 prime numbers. You may not know all I am thinking, but you at least know that I happen to be aware of the prime numbers. And I certainly would not be being very anthropomorphic if I signal by going boop, 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 boop. I mean, that seems rather, you know, I could do amplitude, frequency, or phase, some other kind of modulation.
There's another possible interpretation. You might be playing a brass instrument and avoiding this form of harmonics.
But a composition for a brass instrument which only has a prime number set of is a very interesting boundary condition. But in any case, the existence of intelligence.
It happens to be the boundary condition which we use. We reject all the prime numbers above five, as it happens. But if we were musically more advanced, perhaps we would.
Well, either way, it would be a sign of intelligent life. So we would surely...
Well, intelligence.
We want to distinguish between the announcement signal and the message. So my point there is that merely to say, look, here we are, we're not all that stupid, is easy. But now, to come to the thrust of your remark, how do we go beyond that? And here, to my mind, the most clever and general solution that has been proposed, as far as I know, is the suggestion of Frank Drake, that you send repeated clusters of signals, let's say zeros and ones, just for convenience, binary information, and the sum of the number of bits is the product of two prime numbers. Now, that being the case, one is and you'll have to judge how anthropomorphic this next step is. One is tempted to set them up in a rectangular array. So if it's 551 zeros and ones, you say, my goodness, that's 19 times 29. I will set up 19 rows of 29 columns. That doesn't look like anything. I'll set up 29 rows of 19 columns. My goodness, what's that funny thing with a head? You can send pictures without any prior agreement. And you can send two and three and four-dimensional pictures, and the bit rates can be enormous. So just, we can't possibly go through it, but let me show you the first radio message that has been sent consciously from the planet Earth. This was done at the dedication of the resurfaced Arecibo telescope, not as a serious attempt. We aimed it at something 13,000 light years away. We don't expect an answer right away, but merely as an indication of the technological capability. And without saying more than a few words, let me just say what's in this message, which is the product of two prime numbers. There is how we count in binary notation. We just go 1, 2, 3, 4 with some parity bits. The atomic numbers of the atoms which we happen to be fond of, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus, and then having established that convention, all of the purine and pyrimidine bases are given in generic formulae because we think they're nice. And sugar phosphate backbone and a symbolic double helix here. A number in binary notation, you can always tell whether it's a number by the parity bit, showing the number of nucleotides in a single chromosome. And then this fellow, who will be deeply mysterious. The sun and the planets, the fellow is standing above planet number 3, and planet number 3 is offset, so we're trying to say something about that. A number of a little less than 4 billion, which we intend to be the number of occupants of that planet. And then a very hard to draw radio telescope, a crude representation of the radio telescope, with the height of the human being and the aperture of the radio telescope both given in units of the frequency of transmission, the wavelength of transmission. Well, that is something for you to judge on anthropomorphism. We have not had even the opinion of dolphins or whales and whether they can understand it. I can tell you that such messages are readily understood by uncoached physicists, but that may not be a representative example of cosmic intelligence.
Do uncoached physicists know the structure of the purine and pyrimidine bases?
Good question. Very small number of them.
Peter Shaw, Computer Management Dynamics. I would like to ask Dr. Sagan one very simple question. Much of our scientific discussion tonight is based on the fact, and we have spoken earlier on this matter, that we are constrained by the speed of light. If there are civilizations outside, very much more advanced than we are, how do we know that they haven't solved this problem? And our transmissions are loitering around in space at 186,000 miles a second.
I can only say that the speed of light is in a very different category from, say, the speed of sound, which was the sound barrier was a mere technological barrier. The speed of light is, as far as we understand, built into the fabric of physics. That is, the universe is constructed in such a way that we can understand it if no material object can exceed the speed of light, and it is deeply mysterious if material objects can exceed the speed of light. Now, it may be that some very clever fellow will turn up next year and say, look, I can explain all the things Einstein explains without assuming a limitation of the velocity of light, but that would have to be a very clever fellow.
Thank you, Professor Sagan. Good night.